Hello, I'm Rosie Goldsmith, and a very warm welcome to the Slightly Foxed podcast, brought to you by the Slightly Foxed team here in Hoxton Square, London. Today, we bring you not just one author, but a whole family of them. For this episode, we're at home with the Brontes, with the three writing sisters, Emily, Anne and Charlotte, and their brother Branwell and parents Patrick and Maria, at home in the Haworth Parsonage in Yorkshire. We're devoting a whole episode to the story of the Bronte Parsonage and to how the house and the wild moorland surrounding it influenced their writing. We also want to hear about the parsonage's role today as a museum and place of Bronte pilgrimage for thousands of visitors a year. And, of course, we will talk about the famous Bronte novels, from Wuthering Heights to Jane Eyre and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. To help me tell the story of the Brontes and their home, we're privileged to have with us the Keeper of the Keys, Anne Dinsdale, who is Principal Curator at the Bronte Parsonage and has written extensively about the family and their home. There is quite simply no better person to have as our guest, so welcome, Anne. It's great to have you here. Thank you for coming all the way from Yorkshire.
Thank you.
We'll talk at length later. Now, as we can't actually all sit around the kitchen table with the Brontes themselves in Haworth to record this podcast, Anne Dinsdale and I are sitting round the kitchen table here in the Slightly Foxed office with publishers and editors Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. So hello to both of you. Nice to see you again. And as we always like to do before we kick off our main discussion, let's hear from Gail and Hazel what Slightly Foxed has been up to in the past 3 months since we last met. So Gail...
Well, we've all had holidays, which has been lovely because we're facing a very busy autumn, starting off with the launch of a novella by Ascender Maxton Graham called Love Divine. Hazel, are you going to tell us a bit about it?
Yes. Well,
over to you. I think that's a cue, Hazel.
Well, it is a treat, and a number of you will probably know Ascender's other books, which were immensely popular. And this one is set in a small village on the outskirts of London called Lamley Green, which is without a vicar. And there's a sort of unrest, feeling of unrest in the village. Everyone's a bit at sea. And it follows members of the congregation through from Christmas to New Year with a sort of mystery at the heart of it all. It's very cleverly told with a sort of scattering of emails, parish minutes, letters, and it's a rare treat, so I recommend it.
I think vicars is very good for this particular episode because the Brontes, of course, their father was a
yes, indeed,
a vicar, a yes, curate. Yes, so yeah. Yes,
no, it's a rattling good read and perfect for Christmas. I
yes,
think.
Wonderful.
So we've got that at the end of October, and then Reader's Day, which is our sort of 1 day literary festival, on the 8th of November.
Are there any tickets still?
No, I'm afraid tickets are sold out, but there is a waiting list. There is a waiting list. And then in the end of the month, we will be publishing the next Slightly Foxed edition, which is a deliciously funny account, memoir, by a girl who was a chorus girl in the late 1930s. And she joined a troupe called the Millerettes, who travelled to Sweden. And then she and some of her fellow dancers went off to Paris to the Folies Bergères, and they danced with Josephine Baker.
A true story.
True story. And then they went on tour in Holland, Germany, Italy. And this is 1937 to 1939. So you get the contrast between, you know, the showgirl world, which was quite extraordinary.
And the build-up of politics.
And the build-up of politics, exactly. In fact, she gets to go to Germany with another troupe called the Basel Beauties because they don't want to take a Jewish dancer to Germany because for obvious reasons.
Gosh, this is
so it's very entertaining and beautifully illustrated. And then we've got the winter issue, which is full of wonderful things to read or reread. So T.H. White's Once and Future King, the Tetralogy. Very good article by Sam Leith on that. Mm-hmm. Daisy Hay writes about P.D. James's Adam Dalgliesh crime novels. She's a bit of a fan. Someone else is writing on the poetry of Gerald Manley Hopkins. We've got something on a Rosamund Lehman novel.
Oh!
So
honestly, you're ticking all my boxes today. Yeah.
So
this
there
is
are
really
lots
exciting.
Of lots of very varied articles.
And a rather sort of contemporary, sort of appropriate thriller about someone who's been poisoned with mushrooms.
Oh, so, thinking of Australian mushroom poisoners.
Yes, that's John Lanchester, A Debt to Pleasure.
A Debt to Pleasure, yes.
Yes, so some good Christmas reading.
High waving heather, neath stormy blast bending.
Midnight and moonlight and bright shining star.
Now, 2018 was the bicentenary of Emily's birth, and the group The Unthanks set her poetry, her wonderful poetry, to music, composing what they called the Emily Bronte Song Cycle. And they actually played these on the piano in the Bronte Parsonage.
All down the mountainsides, wild forest lending, one mighty voice.
And that is what you've just been hearing. Anne Dinsdale, back to you, Anne. Anne is principal curator of the Bronte Parsonage Museum in Haworth and an expert on the Brontes and their lives and works. She's the author of several books, the latest this year, Let Me In, The Brontes in Bricks and Mortar, which she wrote with Sharon Wright, and also At Home with the Brontes and The Bronte Parsonage Museum Guide. So welcome again, Anne. Right, well, over to you and me. I want to know everything there is to know about the Bronte Parsonage, the museum, and your connection with it. Now, you've been at the Bronte Parsonage Museum for 36 years.
Yes, that's right. Nearly longer than the Brontes themselves.
Gosh, now I know you don't live there, but it must feel as though you do.
Yeah, it does actually. I live very close by, but I do spend all my working day at the Parsonage. We also have a research library, and I've got a beautiful office in the library, so I'm actually looking out on the churchyard.
Did you ever imagine you'd be as connected, as you know, such, for such a long time as you have been?
And no.
And will this work continue the rest of your life, do you think? Want it to?
Yeah, I mean, at some point I am going to have to retire, but I do hope that I'll be able to kind of continue the Bronte interest in some way. My interest in the Brontes came about when I was very young. I visited the parsonage on a school trip when I was quite a young child, and I didn't actually know who the Brontes were or what they'd done. More excited about a trip on the Worth Valley Steam Railway. But I think that first visit really captured my imagination. I'm one of three sisters, and I also have a brother. So that was
exactly the same constellation.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I think that was a connection. But it was the whole experience, the house, and that kind of feeling that the sisters had just walked out of the room that really inspired me.
When did you get into the writing? When did you start reading the novels?
I started with Jane Eyre when I was 11. So quite young.
Early, yeah. Yes. It must have had an enormous impact on, if you understood it, I suppose, at that age too.
Yeah, I mean, I probably understood it on a completely different level. But I think, you know, those scenes of Jane's childhood at the terrible Lowood school. And I remember as a child kind of burning with indignation at the way that she was treated. And from Jane Eyre, I went on to Wuthering Heights, and I'm really not sure how much I understood of that book. But I was absolutely captivated, and I've returned to the Bronte novels many times.
Did you grow up in that area yourself? Is that part of the passion, do you think?
I grew up in Keighley, which is very close to Haworth. So, you know, the Brontes are kind of very well known around Haworth.
Before we move on, I actually just want to ask Gail and Hazel whether they've actually been to the parsonage. Did you have a childhood school visit or
not
adult?
No. In fact, a group of us from Slightly Foxed went some years ago, and I think we were on a trip to go and visit our printers, who are only about 10 miles away from Haworth. And being literary people, we decided we'd go for a visit. And I remember it very vividly, the setting, you know, on the edge of the moor. The thing that stuck in my mind most was when we were there, I don't know if it's still there was a glass case with a mannequin dressed in one of Charlotte Bronte's dresses. And I can remember looking at it and thinking, I mean, she was tiny, absolutely tiny waist, tiny feet. It could have been a sort of a modern 11, 12-year-old child's outfit. Mm. But it did make a real impression. And I think when you see it, you know, it helps you understand the circumstances in which they wrote those novels.
No, I agree.
It has a sort of resonance to it, which I think is the case in many writers' houses, you know, that it informs the work.
Absolutely. Hazel, what about you?
I'm afraid I haven't. I'm afraid my upbringing was grimly Southern. but actually, I almost feel as if I have been there somehow, you know, looking at Anne's books. Mm. And also I did watch the Sally Wainwright
To Walk Invisible,
which I thought was brilliant, actually.
Yeah.
Yes.
We were very involved with the whole production of that particular drama. We spent weeks working with the production team because they actually recreated the parsonage as it would have looked in the 1840s on Penistone Hill, just behind the real parsonage.
Yes.
Excellent.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I'm sure there's a lot. Well, tell us more about the parsonage, about the museum, and about your work too. Can you describe how parsonage to us?
The parsonage is a Georgian house. It was built in 1778, and it is surrounded on two sides by quite a grim churchyard. So the Brontes were looking out on their father's church, and then at the back of the house, wild moorland. And in the Brontes' time, the parsonage was virtually the last house before you kind of went on to the moorland. Haworth itself was quite a grim industrial township when the Brontes came to Haworth.
They came to Haworth from Thornton, where the children were born.
Yes.
Which wasn't that far away, a few miles.
Yeah, just a few miles away. And the four famous children were born at Thornton, as you say, which is part of Bradford. They arrived in Haworth in 1820 when Patrick became perpetual curate.
The father became minister of the church. Then,
yeah.
Yes.
And he arrived at the parsonage with his Cornish wife, Maria.
I'm so pleased about this because I come from Cornwall and almost in every podcast I've managed to find some Cornish connection.
Yeah. She came to visit relatives in Yorkshire, met Patrick Bronte while she was visiting. There was a whirlwind courtship and they were married very quickly. And then the children started to arrive virtually, you know, cutting hot on the heels of each other.
He was from Northern Ireland, wasn't he? He was born in County Down.
Yeah, that's right. He came from quite a humble background. Through sheer hard work and ambition, he found a place at Cambridge University and sort of transformed himself into a well-educated Church of England clergyman. And Patrick Bronte also published collections of poetry and prose, which I've got to say is not great literature, but it did mean that his children grew up seeing their family name in print on the parsonage bookshelves. And I think that was hugely important, you know, when they came to publish their own work. So they had that idea of, you know, a member of their family who'd already published his work.
So Patrick moved with his family. Two children died in very early years, and then there were four more children, so six in total. Describe their house, what it looked like inside, and what we can still see today.
It's quite a beautiful, quite an elegant house, very neat and symmetrical. The rear of the building is kind of smaller windows and kind of more cottagey. But it would have been a real kind of step up for Patrick Bronte. And when you visit today, it is actually furnished using the Bronte's own furniture and their household items. And as you go around the house, everything that you see on display has kind of come on a long journey, and it's been acquired by the Bronte Society over the years.
So the Bronte Society is the organisation, the membership organisation that runs the museum, the parsonage.
Right. That's right. So the Bronte Society was formed in 1893 and they acquired the parsonage in 1928. So that is nearly 100 years ago.
So of all the 9,000 items you have in the museum, tell us a little bit about them. I mean, what are they? Are they clothes? Are they manuscripts? Are they
It's a bit of everything,
pens?
Actually. We obviously have first editions and books that were owned by the Brontes themselves. We've got manuscripts and letters. We've got a lot of clothing. We have the sisters' writing desks, a lot of needlework boxes and sewing implements in the collection. So it's a really quite a varied collection of material.
Do you have the original manuscripts?
Sadly, no. The manuscripts for Wuthering Heights by Emily and the two novels by Anne Bronte haven't survived. Charlotte's manuscripts were preserved by her publisher, and her manuscripts for Jane Eyre, Shirley, and Villette are now at the British Library in London.
Would you like to have them?
Yeah, it'd be good.
Yeah. Well, you've got a lot though, but I imagine it is also quite a responsibility for you as custodian to be overseeing all this, to be responsible for this extraordinary place and these items.
Yeah, well, the important thing is that these items are accessible to people, you know, for everybody to enjoy. And we do work with, you know, other organisations like the British Library. When new Bronte material comes onto the market, you know, we kind of liaise and decide whose collection it best belongs with.
How many visitors do you get a year, and what kind of people are they? I mean, I imagine there's a huge variety.
Yeah, a huge variety. We get around 70,000 visitors a year at the moment, and they range from children coming on school trips, just as I do.
Is it still obligatory in that part of the world to go?
No, it ought to be.
I agree.
But we get a lot of families, and we get students, academics, just kind of everybody, really.
Interestingly, the Bronte tourism idea actually began quite early, didn't it? Because as you said, Charlotte herself was quite famous already in her lifetime.
Yeah.
And from what I can tell, what I was reading in preparation was, this was because of the biography of Charlotte Bronte by Elizabeth Gaskell, which had been commissioned by Charlotte's very own father.
Yeah.
Now, this came out a couple of years after Charlotte died. Tell us about the impact of that, because I think it's amazing that these women, well, particularly Charlotte, were so well known in their in their own time.
The Life of Charlotte Bronte by Elizabeth Gaskell was written in response to the huge interest in Charlotte Bronte's life. People wanted to understand, you know, how the Brontes had come to write their novels. So responding to a request from Patrick Bronte, Mrs. Gaskell wrote her biography. And of course, that combination of the originality and the power of the novels, combined with this quite tragic story of the Brontes' lives and then the wild scenery at Haworth, was a really potent mix. And so people started coming to Haworth very early on. And I think as well there was an idea that all the locations, the houses in the Bronte novels had real-life counterparts, and people could actually kind of physically visit the landscapes of the Bronte's imagination.
Let's talk about very specifically about the influence of the house and the life they had and the surroundings on their novels, and Gail and Hazel want to jump in at any point as well too, because living in the parsonage, obviously there was religious influence as well.
Yeah.
The houses were not particularly comfortable. They were, as you say, it was an industrial town. It was a very tough life, and they all died pretty young from illness, from tuberculosis mainly. So, you know, how did they live, and how did they write, and how did the two connect?
After their first disastrous episode of going away to the clergy daughter's school and the deaths of the elder girls, Patrick Bronte educated his girls at home, which meant that they got quite an unconventional education in that they were allowed to sit in on Branwell's more academic works. And out of lesson time, they created this rich imaginary world. And everything they read, everything they learned, or the village gossip. It all kind of fed into these imaginary kingdoms, which were kind of sparked by Patrick's gift to Branwell of a set of toy soldiers. And each of the children adopted a soldier and they gave them names and characters. And they would act out sort of fairly childish plays with the soldiers, which got more and more complex and sophisticated. And they started writing and documenting the adventures of the soldiers.
How old were they at this point?
Charlotte would have been about 10 at that period. So
they were all about one year between each other.
Yeah, Branwell would have been 9, Emily 8 and Anne 6. And these extraordinary miniature books that corresponded in scale with the toy soldiers. And they would write their stories in the tiniest, tiniest handwriting, which became like a secret code because if their father or their aunt stumbled across any of these tiny books, they just wouldn't be able to read them. And I think those tiny books that they created at the parsonage in childhood kind of provided the basis for the adult novels. They were so kind of involved in their imaginary worlds that it never really lost its hold on them.
Did they have much freedom as children to go out and walk or were they very protected?
They did get quite a lot of freedom, and a daily walk on the moors was very much part of their routine. Their father was a great walker with a passion for the natural world around him, which he passed on to all his children.
Do you have a very sort of clear picture of their father? Because I've read that he was sort of very strict, in fact, and you know, the secret language was partly because he would have disapproved of what they were doing.
I think he probably would have disapproved.
But he was also very admiring of them, wasn't he, as well, somehow?
Yeah, he was a very, very complex personality. He admitted himself that he was eccentric, but felt that that had kind of contributed towards, you know, the way his children turned out. He was very politically minded and he did pass on a lot of his interest to his children. I think he was a very inspiring character.
Did he pass on a lot of his, and obviously he would have talked to them about religion and so on, but if you think of the novels, how some would call them amoral, and not particularly religious, but how would you describe that influence on their lives?
Well, I think he had a very enlightened approach to education, in that his girls, as well as his only son, kind of benefited from him passing on what he'd learnt at Cambridge. And he didn't censor, with a couple of exceptions, he didn't censor their reading. So they were kind of steeped in the works of Byron, who would have been considered deeply unsuitable reading material. And that had a huge impact on their own work. If you think about the characters in the novels, you know, Heathcliff, Rochester, they are incredibly Byronic.
Yes, no wonder I fell in love with them.
Yeah.
But if you think of that one magical year, 1847, when the three girls each published probably their best known novels.
That's right.
You had Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, and Agnes Grey from Charlotte, Emily, and Anne.
Yeah.
What a year.
Yeah.
Now, did they read to each other? Did they comment on each other's works? Did they influence each other? That year must have been extraordinary in their lives.
I think it was. I mean, their very first publication actually appeared in 1846, but it was pretty much unnoticed, and that was a collection of poetry that they published under their pseudonyms Currer, Ellis and Acton Bell, with each sister retaining her own initials. And we do know that Charlotte had longed to be forever known as a poet. So she must have been absolutely crushed when the book sold two copies. But I think it's remarkable that she never lost faith in herself as a writer. And she was largely responsible for kind of pushing her sisters into writing a novel. So although Jane Eyre, it had actually been written after her sister's novels, they did share their writing at that point. And we know that every evening they had this routine of walking around the family dining room table, reading aloud from their work and talking about their writing.
Gosh, isn't this wonderful to hear this from your mouth? It does bring it all to life. And I'm just thinking of the images, that the pictures we have of them, of course, thanks to Branwell, who was a very talented painter. He painted his sisters, and not his father, I don't think, did he?
No, he originally included himself in the very famous portrait, which is now in the National Portrait.
So you haven't got that
gallery.
Either?
No, we haven't got that either. We have had it on loan, but he didn't get very far with his own portrait, maybe because the composition would have been quite crowded by a fourth figure. So he turned himself into a pillar, which is why it's often known as the pillar portrait. And over the years, the paint has become more translucent, so you kind of get this ghostly fourth figure emerging.
Branwell was he was one of the sort of tragedies of their lives.
That's right.
As far as I could make out.
In childhood, I think he was the leading light in all their family activities. He was considered to be the genius of the family, and he couldn't quite decide whether he was going to be a famous writer or a great artist. But as he became an adult, I think it became increasingly clear that he couldn't hold down even a relatively humble position. And in the end, you know, his father became a quite hard act to follow, and he sought oblivion in alcohol and opium.
Now, we've mentioned death and illness a few times, and I think, I mean, for me, this is, you know, I knew this in the back of my mind that they died young, but honestly, it was really quite hard to read it again, to read, you know, that they died in their 30s, died of tuberculosis, and in fact, there were 6 children, all of them died.
Yeah.
And then Patrick was the only surviving member.
That's right.
So he died much, much later. He lived into his 80s. So Charlotte died age 38, so she lived the longest.
Yeah.
And she wrote Jane Eyre, Shirley and Villette, so 3 novels. She managed to get 3 in there.
Yeah, and then there was The Professor, which was published after her death.
Yes. And then Emily died age 30, and she wrote In Speech Once just 1 great novel, Wuthering Heights. And Branwell as he was known, he was 31. And then Anne was 29, and she published Agnes Grey and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, which brings me to this question of, you know, how they lived and the proximity of illness and death. And I mean, it's such a heavy weight on their lives. Tell us what you think that did to them, the impact it had on them.
Well, death is ever present. Would have been at the parsonage. I mean, we've already talked about the churchyard. Their father's church, which they could see through the parsonage windows, where the family vault with their mother and their 2 older sisters, was a sad reminder of death. And Haworth itself, I think people have a kind of idea of it, you know, Wuthering Heights, purple heather, but it was actually very dirty, very overcrowded, and the average life expectancy was 25.8 years. Haworth, compared with the worst of the London slum districts, statistically.
Which, I mean, in an awfully ironic way, enhances their status because they produce just these few novels, which of course are, I'm going to use that word, iconic.
Yeah.
But just think what they could have done. Mm. That's the other thing, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, whether you think that the limitations, the pressures on them because they knew that maybe they wouldn't live very long actually, you know, fired them up, whether this was part of their creativity.
We do have in the collection at the parsonage, we have a very, very moving letter, which is believed to be the last letter that Anne Bronte ever wrote, in which she quite bravely confronts the prospect of death. But she goes on to say that she wishes it would please God to spare her because she's got many schemes in her head that she would like to live to bring about. And we can only imagine what they might have been.
Let's talk a little bit more. We've mentioned it already in passing, how their work was actually received at the time, because this is the wonderful aspect of all this. They were published in their day, and they were read.
Yeah.
And apart from the poetry, which obviously needs an even greater audience and probably does have many more admirers now today, but the novels themselves, they were published and they did have an influence and people read them.
That's right. Well, Jane Eyre was the first to be published, and it was an overnight sensation.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah. At that time as well. How many copies were there?
I couldn't tell you exactly what the first print run. I mean, print runs were obviously a lot smaller, and novels were published in a 3-volume format. But it was an overnight sensation, and Charlotte Bronte literally woke up to find herself famous.
People banging at the door.
Well, no,
paparazzi or whatever the equivalent was.
She was there,
she was shielded by her identity as Currer-Bell. And it was the topic of Literary London, you know, who is Currer-Bell? There was a real interest. All kinds of stories were circulating. One of them being that the novel had been written by a discarded governess of Thackeray, you know, the novelist who Charlotte greatly admired, author of Vanity Fair. So there were all kinds of speculation and rumours going round London.
Do you think that people were quite shocked? And obviously when they did find out who'd written these novels, you know, which were, you know, sex, violence, the, you know, an incredible mix, to find out that these were daughters of a vicar.
Well, it's interesting because everybody loved Jane Eyre initially, and then 3 months later, Wuthering Heights and Agnes Grey by Ellis and Acton Bell appeared. And people read them because there was this rumour that they were earlier productions of the author of Jane Eyre. And people were shocked by Wuthering Heights. I mean, it is a gut-wrenching sort of book, isn't it?
It is
brutal, it's violent. And it actually started to have an impact on people reading Jane Eyre. And suddenly, people turned to reread Jane Eyre with fresh eyes and found all kinds of shocking aspects to the book, which they'd not picked up on earlier. So there's a change in the reviews, and the book begins to be described as unchristian and unchaste. And people, you know, were quite shocked by Jane Eyre, which always strikes me as an incredibly moral kind of a novel.
Yes, interesting. I mean, even though these sisters grew up together and they influenced each other, and obviously they were competitive as well, but they were different, and their books were different too. I mean, Anne, you could easily argue that Tennant and Wildfire Hall is very, very different from the other novels.
Yeah.
How do you think that has helped their legacy, if you like? Because they are, you can see them as completely different novels too.
Yeah, I think Anne is writing with a very different intention than Emily and Charlotte. I think she wanted to make the world a better place, and I think she was the one who became disillusioned with the imaginary kind of games that they played in childhood much earlier. She was the one that spent more time out in the real world, and her second novel, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, was probably considered the most shocking of all the Bronte novels because it's written about a woman who is a wealthy heiress. She makes a very unsuitable marriage to a handsome rake who sets about kind of spending her fortune, and she actually runs away from him, taking her child with her, which would have been illegal at the time.
Now, I know that when people are asked and put on the spot about what is their favourite Bronte novel, many people do mention that novel, and I'm going to put Hazel and Gail on the spot, and then you finally too.
Okay.
And so, Gail, which is your favourite Bronte novel?
Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre, and why?
I think it's because Mr. Rochester gets his just desserts. It's very satisfying.
You didn't fall in love with him then? It wasn't that aspect?
No, I think you realise that, you know, he's dangerous. What also makes me say Jane Eyre is because Jean Rhys's Wide Sargasso Sea is such an incredibly satisfying backstory to the first Mrs. Rochester. I mean, it's not often, is it, that you get a classic that's then informed by a more contemporary novel. But reading the two together is a wonderful experience.
Hazel, what about you?
Yes, well, I've recently, fairly recently, read Villette, and I did really enjoy that. Mm. It's so, so different. But I know it's very, or pretty autobiographical.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
going to work in a school in Brussels and falling in love with the husband of the owner.
That's right.
And I just was terribly sort of taken, first of all, by, well, at the beginning, the portrait of that little girl and her father. There's something so mesmerising yeah. about her character just at that point. And also, you know, the characters of Madame Beck and Monsieur Paul, you know, you can absolutely see them. Actually, I just thought that those two portraits were so, you know, rounded and kind of powerful, really.
Yeah. Villette is, was 1853, so it's a little bit later in Charlotte's yeah. life. But I read that and I agree.
Yes. I think the characters in Villette were inspired by real people.
Yes, yes.
And Charlotte admitted that she often took real places and people as a starting
yes.
point.
Yes.
It's interesting that of her four novels, two of them were actually set in Brussels,
yes.
which I think speaks volumes about the impact
yes,
that experience.
They had one foreign trip in their lives,
yeah.
and that was to Brussels.
Yeah.
How on earth did she cope yeah. after her... Yes. Three surviving siblings died. I mean, it must have been devastating. And then
was,
the poor father
yeah.
who, you know, outlived them all by years.
Well, you can tell from Charlotte's letters after the deaths of her siblings, it's just her and her father
mm.
all day together at the parsonage. And they're both kind of looking out, watching for any sign of illness on the part of the other. You know,
yeah.
it must have been a really, really difficult time for
yes.
Charlotte, a really heartbreaking
yeah.
time, where she describes as letters, you know, from the world beyond Haworth as being like a lifeline. And of course she turned to her writing to sustain her.
Yeah.
She was writing her novel Shirley all the period that, you know, her siblings were sickening and dying, which I think accounts for it being quite a difficult
mm-hmm.
book.
But it's also, I mean, the fact that she was able to write in that mm. time as well too, and she was the only one who got married.
That's right, yeah. I think Charlotte's an incredibly brave character.
Mm. Yeah. So, Anne, I'm going to ask you, which is your favourite
novel? I love Jane Eyre, and I would say it is my second favourite. But for me, it's Wuthering Heights.
Mm.
It's such an original and weird book. And I think there are a lot of people who read Wuthering Heights and don't like it. But I think if you do like it, it really kind of starts to obsess you. It's a life-changing book, I think.
So we come to the present day. We're talking about reading now. And of course, you have readers, admirers, academics, researchers coming to the parsonage
yeah.
today. And you have some incredible people. I know that Tracy Chevalier is one of your
yes,
great
is.
Supporters
yeah.
and visitors.
Yeah.
And what else is happening there today? Bring us up to date. 2025.
Well, we have a very lively contemporary art programme. And we've currently just finished our Bronte Festival of Women's Writing, which Tracy appeared at.
How many years has that been running?
15 years.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
gosh.
And we've had some amazing people coming to talk and do events with us.
Is it always women?
Usually.
Do men like the Brontes?
Yeah, they do. They do. I've got to say it's predominantly women. I think, you know, that probably because of some of the film adaptations, there's a kind of belief that the novels are romances. But clearly, if you get back to the original text, they're not romances.
That's another thing that you are responsible for as well, is overseeing and approving filming TV and films, either in the parsonage or of the novels as well. Tell us about that aspect of your working life.
Well, I don't think we can either approve or disapprove, really. I mean, we welcome all new adaptations of the Brontes' works. I think it's really important that the Brontes continue to inspire people. So I think it's a wonderful thing that new adaptations inspired by their lives and works continue to appear.
Now, there is a film coming up in 2026.
There is, yeah.
And I think you can tell us a little bit about that too.
It's a new adaptation of Emily's novel, Wuthering Heights, and it's written and directed by Emerald Fennell. And we are very interested at the Parsonage. Emerald was one of the key speakers at our recent Festival of Women's Writing. She said at the event that she first read the novel when she was 14 and that she became obsessed with it, and she'd read it many times over the years. But for her adaptation, she's gone back to her 14-year-old kind of reading of the novel and based her adaptation on, you know, her kind of feeling about the book at that time.
I've seen the trailer. It's with Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
And it's very steamy.
It is, yeah.
This year is also the year that Bradford is City of Culture.
That's
in the
right,
UK.
Yeah.
Now, they were born in Bradford.
Yeah.
I imagine they had Bradford accents as well.
It's a really interesting question. When Charlotte was 14 and she attended her second boarding school, it was noted that she spoke with a strong Irish accent.
From her father?
Yeah, absolutely. It's never mentioned again. And I think when she made various trips to London, I think if she'd had an Irish accent, it would have been noted and mentioned. So I'm assuming that she had a Yorkshire accent, kind of sort of educated Yorkshire, that people didn't really kind of know.
Now, Bradford obviously feels very protective of their Brontes, and this year has brought some money at least to to supporting your work. So tell us a little bit what Bradford City of Culture has been able to do for the Brontes this
year.
Well,
it has provided us with new visitor toilets, which is actually
important.
Very. And they are quite wonderful.
And of course, they didn't have them then, remember, so...
Yeah.
Even more important.
But I think the other really key thing is that the house that the Brontes were born in Thornton is now open to the public. It's under community ownership and there's going to be a cafe there. The upstairs rooms are now an Airbnb, so you can actually stay in a house where the Brontes lived. So it's quite a wonderful experience, and I sort of had the privilege of spending a night there earlier this year.
What did it feel like?
Well, I didn't actually sleep very much because it is quite overwhelming, you know, that feeling that, oh, you know, I wonder what happened in this room. And, you know, it is quite an extraordinary experience sleeping in that house.
Oh, Anne, I can tell you're fully immersed in this world and this
fully
life.
Fully booked, I should think.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we need to leave it there. But this has been so interesting. I've learned so much. And it's been wonderful listening to you because you've just told us so much that we didn't know. So I'm really, really grateful to you. So thank you to our special guest today, Anne Dinsdale. It's been a real pleasure. And I'm going to do one very indulgent thing because I found a letter that Charlotte wrote in 1841 about Haworth. And it's about the house itself. It's a beautiful letter. And she wrote, "My home is humble and unattractive to strangers, but to me it contains what I shall find nowhere else in the world, the profound and intense affection which brothers and sisters feel for each other when their minds are cast in the same mould, their ideas drawn from the same source, when they've clung to each other from childhood, and when family disputes have never sprung up to divide them." A lovely quote to end. So thank you, Anne, very much again. Now, to all of you listening, don't go away. Stay and join me and Gail and Hazel for our recommended reads after this short notice. Slightly Foxed is a small independent publishing house in Hoxton, East London. It was founded in 2004 by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as a labour of literary love. Slightly Foxed publishes a quarterly magazine which appeals to passionate readers everywhere who enjoy engaging with a wide range of excellent writing, past and present, fiction and non-fiction. Slightly Foxed champions the lost, lesser-known or forgotten literary gems and celebrates the offbeat and unusual. Its contributors are also an eclectic bunch. Some are well-known novelists, distinguished journalists or academics. Others come from very different walks of life. Slightly Foxed also regularly reissues out-of-print books that deserve new audiences. The quarterly magazine has a global readership and is always happy to welcome more readers. It's posted out four times a year to over 60 countries. You can take out an annual subscription at a very reasonable rate, and this also gives you free access to all the back issues and the whole digital archive. That's well over 1,200 articles. If you'd like to subscribe, do visit our website, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd prefer to talk to a human being in the office, then phone us in the London office. Contact details are on the website. Today, the Slightly Foxed family comprises magazines, books, newsletters, the annual Reader's Day, and our podcast. Do join us. And now for our recommended reads, which I know so many listeners love. And I'm going to ask Gail first what her reads are.
Well, I'm going to be cheeky and have two. The first is a really fantastic biography by Ian Collins of the writer Ronald Blythe, and we had a podcast about Ronald Blythe not long ago in which Ian Collins appeared. And when he did that podcast, the book hadn't yet been published, but it has now. It's called Blythe Spirit, and it is terrifically good. I mean, Ronald Blythe was a chronicler of religion and nature and seeing the joy in everyday things, and he lived for 100 years, and he had an affair, famously, with Patricia Highsmith, although he was gay. He was a great mentor of Richard Mabey, friend of John Nash, Cedric Morris, the painters, Ian Forster. Born in poverty, he's almost a saint. He sort of he had a very active sex life when he was younger, which was quite surprising. But he sort of evolved into this rather magical person, wrote over 40 books, always lived in Suffolk. And the biography, it's so clever. It talks about his writing, and particularly Aconfield, which was the book for which, you know, he made his reputation. And blissfully, it has really short chapters, which I can't tell you, with quite a fat book, you can read a chapter before bed and remember it, and then carry on the next day. And the other book, which I haven't yet finished, because it's even longer than the Blythe biography, is called The Brothers York by Thomas Penn, and it's a history of the War of the Roses. So Edward IV and Richard III. And it mercifully has a very large family tree at the beginning, because my goodness, the family relationships between Lancastrians and Yorkists is confusing. But it is a fascinating account of the period, of the deception that goes on, the switched loyalties, the constant rebellions and scheming, and I mean, it brings the whole of late medieval world to life. And my goodness, it was a turbulent time.
Well, thank you very much. Hazel, what about you? What have you been reading?
I've been reading a novel by an American writer called Kent Harouf, who I've never heard of before. My sister-in-law is rather mad about him. And I can see why. It's a novel called Plainsong, and it's about a small town in Colorado, Holt, not very far from Denver. And it's really about a group of people who don't particularly have anything in common with each other, but whose lives sort of interweave. That the real sort of engine of the story is the story of a 17-year-old girl who finds herself pregnant and has nowhere to go, and is chucked out by her mother. And she goes and talks to her teacher, Maggie, and who has the rather sort of inspired but very unusual idea. She takes her out and introduces her to a couple of old farming brothers who are unmarried and who've lived there on their farm for, you know, all their lives, really. And they're sort of inarticulate but kind, and a strange sort of relationship does grow up between them and this girl. They become totally fascinated and dedicated to her and her baby. And it's very, very moving, and I can see why it's called Plain Song. It's very sort of spare writing. It's not about anything extraordinary. It's about the small acts that change people's lives, really. And you do sort of come away feeling somehow the better for having read it.
So this is a new name for me, this author. Remind us of his name again.
He's called Kent Harouf.
Well, thank you. Thank you both so much, Hazel and Gail, for that. And I'm just going to add two to the mix that I just read. One is A Traitor's Legacy by S.J. Paris. And it's set at the end of the Elizabethan period, so 1598, very specifically. And it is a thriller of a kind, and it features a female protagonist called Sophia de Wolf, and she's a spy, and very unusual, of course, for women at that time. It's a really fantastic read. And the other one is a Booker shortlisted book. It's called The Land in Winter by Andrew Miller. And it's set in 1962 in the big freeze in the West Country. I cannot recommend it highly enough. I think that's it, Gail and Hazel. Thank you so much for those wonderful recommendations, as always. So thank you very, very much to Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, to my producer, the wonderful Philippa Goodridge, and the whole team here at Slightly Foxed. That's it for this episode. See you in 3 months' time for yet more compelling storytellers and riveting tales. You'll find all the books and authors we've discussed today in the programme show notes, and you can easily access those on your podcast app or the Foxed website, foxedquarterly.com. And that's where you can also subscribe to our quarterly print magazine. Print or podcast, all of us here at Slightly Foxed are united in our love of books and of great authors, past and present, in reading the best contemporary literature and in rediscovering lost and forgotten literary gems. My name is Rosie Goldsmith. Until next time, thank you so much for joining me.